It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Now, from the most powerful city in the world, a new generation of conservative talk. Fair, fresh, fun. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It's Wednesday, March 29th, 2023. I'm Guy Benson. This is the Guy Benson Show. Thank you very much for being here. Every weekday between 3 and 6 p.m. Eastern, and then afterwards around the clock for free on our podcasts. On demand, no charge. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcasts.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm the political editor at TownHall.com, also a Fox News contributor. On the radio, the lineup, limited again but excellent today, we have U.S. Senator John Thune, Republican South Dakota. He'll be here in studio about an hour from now. Looking forward to having him here. Also, Carol Markowitz at the top of our final hour, just after 5 p.m. Eastern. She'll be here talking about her book and other issues as well. And that should be fun, as it often is with Carol. As we come to the air today, I will again open the show with a conversation about what happened in Nashville this week. The awful shooting at the Covenant School, private Christian school in Tennessee, perpetrated by a trans individual who was apparently briefly a student at that school. There's more information coming out about her or him and the life that that person led and family dynamics. I'm just not really that interested in getting all too much into those details because I don't want to talk too much about this person. Right? The basics matter, although we shy away from using the name. The motive matters, and we're still waiting on some of that information. We'll get to that controversy here in just a second. But 6 people are dead, 3 children, 3 adults. We talked about it as the news broke. We talked about it in great depth and at great length yesterday as well. Now, our media is sometimes collectively at its very worst after events like this, because they go into full activism mode. They abandon really any pretense of objectivity or impartiality. They see these as opportunities to exploit a news cycle to advance an agenda. They become almost, in many cases, not everyone, indistinguishable from activists. And they deeply alienate roughly half the country. I've said it before, I'll end up saying it again. The media is biased across the board in a lot of ways. There are no issues on which they are more biased than abortion and guns. Some of the identity stuff is creeping into it, and of course, there's an element of that to this story as well. And there were people highlighting how a lot of the big banner headlines about the school shooting just completely left out certain major details. Certainly about the suspect. Reuters put out a tweet, an instant classic, an instant Hall of Famer from Reuters. Headline, former Christian school student kills 3 children, 3 staff in Nashville shooting. That's the way they decided to describe that person, identify that person as a former Christian school student. Technically accurate. Not sure if that's the most newsworthy thing about them. Him, I think it's him, is what this person went by most recently. Now, I mentioned this in passing yesterday, but I saw on CNN they had reporters chasing Republicans around the hallways of Congress, which is what they love to do on this stuff. Shove a camera in Republicans' faces. Will you support more gun control? How could you not? They were trying to corner, was the congressman from that neck of the woods down in Nashville who had the photograph of him and his family holding guns. Do you regret the photograph? Will you apologize for the photograph? That whole crucial news story, right? Does the congressman regret photos with guns with his family. Like, that's relevant at all to this. Guns, guns, guns. That's the playbook. Oh, there's a mass shooting. Oh, it's at a school. Man your stations. It's go time. You know the script. You know what to do. I mean, this is how the media treats it every time. And unfortunately, there's a lot of times they've honed their skills on demagoguery. As I pointed out also, and I wrote about this today at townhall.com, after the Gabrielle Giffords shooting, what was that, 2011 in Tucson, Arizona? Totally apolitical, as it turned out. No political motive at all. But the media and the Democrats, working together, as they so often do, instantly decided that this was a Republican rhetoric story. Dangerous Republican rhetoric, lack of civility, these Tea Party Republicans and the awful things they're saying about Obama. You just fast forward a few years, these MAGA Republicans and the awful things they're saying about Democrats or trans people or Joe Biden or whatever it is. It's just like you fill in the blank like Mad Libs, but the result is always the same. Republicans are to blame. And I found like half a dozen CNN headlines from the days around that shooting leaning heavily into the whole Republican rhetoric thing. And they were, of course, demanding comment from Republican lawmakers. And as I pointed out, they ultimately ended up changing the whole seating for the State of the Union address in order to reflect the need for comedy and civility and in our discourse. And it was an echo of the Gabby Giffords that had nothing to do with politics. As Sarah Palin's fault, another thing that just had no roots in reality. They just decided that was a thing. Oh, there was a target map for congressional seats. Clearly, this is why this schizophrenic man who was not political at all decided to go on a rampage. They just ran with it. The facts didn't matter. Not facts first, facts last. And CNN and others just absolutely all in on that narrative. And yet, here we have a radicalized trans person who one might guess, and I don't want to tell you for a fact anything because I actually believe in waiting for facts. I also believe even if this is a dyed-in-the-wool leftist who committed this atrocity for political reasons, you don't blame the trans community, you don't blame the left for it, even though the opposite rule is applied basically always by the left to the right. Two wrongs don't make a right, in my view. But since this is the reporting standard from CNN, this is the template that they've used, you would think that there's enough circumstantial evidence here, certainly, that you could start shoving a microphone into Democratic congressman's face. All right, has the rhetoric gone too far on trans issues and condemning colleagues and various states for their so-called anti-trans actions? Could you be radicalizing people? Are you fostering a climate of hate against conservative Christians? These types of questions, obviously those are not being asked. What CNN did do, however, was write a whole piece where they were phoning up experts, of course, and corporations to demonstrate how corporate America is problematically silent on, quote, gun safety in the wake of what happened. Here's a CNN tweet from today. In the aftermath of the latest mass shooting in a school in Nashville, most companies declined to speak out. Much of corporate America has grown silent on guns. That's what they're doing for quote-unquote journalism. It's just activism. Hello, will you join our left-wing cause? You won't? Oh, that's disturbing. Okay, thank you very much. We're writing about it. It's activism. We just did multiple segments this week about a new poll from the Wall Street Journal. One of the findings from that poll was that roughly two-thirds of Americans believe that companies should not wade into social conflict and political issues just like this. But the reason that so many of them feel compelled to do so is because they get bullied by activists and online mobs and, working hand in glove, mainstream media outlets exactly like CNN. Like, this is not journalism. Oh, there's a mass shooting. Three kids are dead and three adults in Nashville. Let's make sure we get, what, like Pepsi on the record or whatever. That's CNN and one of their big priorities. Now, we're not doing the rhetoric game because that's not helpful this time. It's guns, guns, guns. Got it, everyone? Those are the marching orders. We got it? Yes, we got it. A memo doesn't have to go out. They internally know what to do, intrinsically. It's what they've been trained to do, socialized to do. It's what the tribe does. Now, you could make an argument, as I actually did a moment ago, that it's premature to say that left-wing rhetoric could even potentially be blamed. And again, I don't like playing those games. To me, that is demagoguery. It is speech squelching. It's an attempt to shut people up. But again, their standards are very well established at this point. But if you were to go down that path, I would still like more evidence. I like to see what the manifesto said, for example, and that kind of thing. Another thing that could be premature along the same lines is the determination of whether or not this was a hate crime at Christians, targeted against Christians. We know that it was a targeted attack. We know that this person chose this school, this religious Christian school, for a reason. We know that this person felt alienated and had a lot of grievances related to this stuff. But it might be a little early to definitively say, yes, this was domestic terrorism or a hate crime targeting Christians. Even though that might be likely, I think that law enforcement and these types of determinations have to be based on actual established facts. So there was a question posed to Merrick Garland from Senator Kennedy yesterday, Merrick Garland, the attorney general. And on its face, I actually don't have a problem with the answer. Listen to Cut 27, then I have another thought afterwards.
Do you plan on opening a hate crime investigation for the targeting of Christians?
The FBI and ATF are both on the scene working with the local police. As of now, motive hasn't been identified, and the police chief said at his last press conference that they don't yet have reached a conclusion with respect to motive. We are certainly working full-time with them to try and determine what the motive is. And, of course, motive is what determines whether it's a hate crime or not.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, fair enough, Mr. Attorney General. In a vacuum, I say that's a fair answer. Do we live in a vacuum? Oh, I can remember when the Justice Department, led by Merrick Garland, went stampeding into a full-blown federal investigation into the state of Georgia for voter suppression based on a giant political lie. They did not hesitate there. The facts did not matter. They politicized that as soon as they could for political reasons, by definition. I remember when the Department of Justice, working in cahoots with the Department of Education and that National School Board, got the FBI in a memo to like sick them on a bunch of parents for being a little too obstreperous at school board meetings. Totally about politics. DOJ happily barreled right into that under this guy's leadership. But far be it from the Biden administration to jump to any conclusions about a hate crime in this case. They only jump to conclusions when it's about, say, smearing Border Patrol agents on whips and whipping that never existed. Catch my drift? They are more than happy to jump to conclusions, even totally wrong ones, immediately, prematurely, before the facts come in, for political reasons, except when they're not. Except when they're not. Like this case, where six Christians are dead. So again, I like the answer from Garland, except for the whole track record, or at least part of the track record leading up to this, very careful. We have to be very careful and consider the evidence, and all, except, never mind that when it suits our purposes in other cases. Yep. Now, there's a lot more that I want to get to. President Biden has had some weird, awkward moments in the aftermath of this shooting. I've got some audio to play for you of Uncle Joe as soon as we come back. It's the Guy Benson Show. Stay tuned.
Fresh conservative talk. Guy Benson Show. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
I'm Guy Benson. We're back. So when the shooting happened in Nashville, within a few hours, President Biden gave some remarks about it. We played the sound here on Monday. We turned that around in a matter of minutes. And I agreed with some of what he said, disagreed with other things that he said. But right before he said what he said, he arrived at an event and he made sort of an awkward joke. He was talking about ice cream to the people who were there. And it was on camera, so in case you missed it, cut six is what it sounded like.
My name is Joe Biden. I'm Dr. Joe Biden's husband. And I ate Jenny's ice cream, chocolate chip. I came down because I heard there was chocolate chip ice cream. By the way, I have a whole refrigerator full upstairs. You think I'm kidding? I'm not.
So, and then he was just like, but anyway, folks, let's talk about the mass shooting. And he was getting dragged for that. And I didn't drag him for that. We had the sound. I saw the tweets and the sort of outrage about it, and people were attacking him. And I decided not to go there because there were people gathered for a different purpose. He was doing some of his typical jokes about being Jill's husband, and we know he loves ice cream or whatever. He was kind of warming up the crowd. It was awkward to then transition to comments about a mass shooting, but to me, it was just awkward. That's it. However, earlier he was asked about the question, the subject of whether what happened in Nashville is a hate crime against Christians. And it's kind of hard to hear because of the aircraft in the background, but you can hear the question, the response from Biden, then a follow-up, and then the joke that Biden makes. Cut five.
Do you believe that Christians were targeted?
I have no idea.
Josh Hawley believes they were. What do you say to that?
Well, I probably don't then.
I have no idea.
All right, so I'll just translate that for you because it was tough to hear. Reporter asks, do you believe that Christians were targeted? By the way, Christians were targeted. Christian school. The school was chosen specifically by the shooter. Christians were targeted, not even a hate crime specifically, were Christians targeted. Biden says, I have no idea. I don't love that answer, but it's at least defensible. I have no idea. So then a reporter says, well, Josh Hawley, Republican senator from Missouri, thinks that they were targeted. So then Biden says, well, I probably don't then. As in, oh, haha, if Josh Hawley thinks that Christians were targeted, then obviously I disagree because we don't like Josh Hawley. We don't like Josh Hawley. Am I right, folks? But the reporter starts to say, oh, so you don't. Then Biden says, no, I'm joking. I'm joking. I have no idea. I gave him a pass on the ice cream stuff. To me, that was frivolous. This is just beyond awkward. This is beyond cringe. Sir, you're the president of the United States. There's been a mass shooting that you're very upset about. Six people are dead, three kids. A senator from the other party quite reasonably believes that Christians may have been targeted. And then you just jokingly say that just reflexively you must disagree with Josh Hawley. And he sort of laughed. No one else laughed. It's just a bad, weird look for Biden. In that moment, given the context. More to say right after this.
You're listening to a new generation of talk, Guy Benson.
Glad to have you here. It's the Guy Benson Show, GuyBensonShow.com, our online home. A podcast is always free. As you have guessed, perhaps, I have a lot to say and continue to have a lot to say about what transpired in Nashville on Monday and the reaction to it. And I think we're seeing some patterns play out, especially in the media, which is what we opened with, that underscore the reasons why so many people have disdain and contempt and distrust for so many people in the media. I saw one journalist, and I tweeted about this yesterday, one journalist who was lamenting that some conservatives were talking about the trans identity of the shooter as a means to, quote, shift the conversation away from gun control. Now, I've been very clear. I don't think that we should scapegoat any community or blame any group of people for the actions of an individual. But also, the identity of the suspect, if there were political dynamics at play, motive, these are relevant things. But journalists are bemoaning the fact that, oh, this is like a quintessential Republicans pounce type of dynamic here. Well, we want to talk about only guns. We would love to talk about rhetoric and motive and guns if the rhetoric and the motive were helpful to our tribe and our narrative. But since they're not, potentially, we only want to talk about guns. And how dare these people try to shift the conversation away from the thing that we want to talk about as activists. Oh, excuse me, journalists. Newsweek has a story. The headline that the manifesto release raises major concerns from LGBTQ plus groups. So they're worried that the manifesto could reflect poorly on the LGBT activist community and people might ascribe to the broader community some of the murderous hate in the manifesto, if that's what it is. And so they are urging the state of Tennessee and news outlets not to release or publish the manifesto. And they quote one LGBT leader saying that the focus really needs to be on, quote, the deadly weaponry and its availability. So again, speak only of the guns. That's the rule here, okay? We don't want any of this other stuff, this other information. Let's not do that. That's dangerous. That's too much dangerous information. Let's focus on the agenda of guns. NBC had a story out, you know, within a day of the shooting talking about the true victims in all of this, which is the trans community in Nashville, how they live in fear. And this only makes things worse. Let me say very clearly that we should not be rude or mean or worse to anyone based on who they are or their identities. There were some very ugly examples, for example, of Islamophobic attacks after 9/11. I think we can be clear-eyed about the Islamist extremism threat without smearing Muslims as a broad group, right? Same thing here. A trans person, and there's a few other examples actually in recent months of trans people going on shooting sprees. You don't have to say, aha, well, those people are the problem. And I get maybe being a trans person in a conservative state, there's some discomfort there, there's some anxiety there. All that being said, a trans person shot a bunch of Christians and targeted them based on everything that we know. Maybe the victimhood story here is not about trans people being victimized. Maybe the story this week is about Christians feeling fearful as six fellow Christians were just gunned down in cold blood, quite possibly because they're Christians. Can we just maybe step away from the preordained, good, approved narratives, even for like 48 or 72 hours? Is that something that the media has the capacity to do? Well, NBC racing out. It's like, oh, well, let's talk about how dangerous a moment this is for the trans community. And I'm not saying there's nothing to that, but I also feel like if a community less favored by the mainstream media had been targeted, I don't think this story gets written. Now, as for the question about the manifesto, let's think about this together for a second. I've told you, including today, and whenever there's a mass shooting, unfortunately, far too often in the years that we've been on the air here, when this happens, we make it a policy not to share, as to the greatest extent possible, not to share the name of the killer, because you don't want to glorify these people or make them famous. They seek notoriety. They seek infamy. That's part of this sort of sick process. For that same reason, I don't think it's a great thing to just publish out into the world the demented rantings and screeds of people who have just committed a giant atrocity, because that's what they want. is perhaps why we get more of this stuff. It's like, oh, I'm very, very unhappy. I'm very, very angry. I want to go out in a blaze of glory and make my mark in this sick, twisted way. And if I do it this way, especially at a school, the more death, the younger the kids, the better, apparently. My name and face and grievances will be all over TV, all over the media. And if I leave behind a note about how unfair the world has been to me or whatever, they'll publish it and people will get to read my words. It's an incentive for more of this. So for that reason, I'm not a big advocate for just releasing this stuff and publishing it. Do I think the overall content is relevant, especially if it goes to motive? Yes. I'm not saying they should censor it and say, you know, we can't tell you anything about it. I'm just not sure being like, well, here you go. Read the crazy person's ranting before they shot six people. I think there's a fair case to be made not to do that, while at least summarizing and getting some of like the gist of it out, because that's relevant information. And what you're seeing here, and there's multiple stories about this in the press, all this navel-gazing and quoting certain people. You've got LGBT activists and journalists. Well, you know, how this might reflect on the community could be very dangerous, and we urge you, please focus on guns instead. Let's not go down this path, etc. The decision about publishing or not publishing a manifesto like this, in my mind, should not depend on the political utility of the identity questions at play, right? Like, if it's helpful to the left, like, here's an example. Like, if there's, let's say, God forbid, hypothetically, the roles had been reversed here, and some right-winger had gone and shot up some sort of LGBT center, and they left behind a manifesto that made it very clear this was a right-wing person motivated by hate, there is no chance that LGBT activists and journalists would be saying, oh, well, don't tell us that. That's too dangerous. That could reflect poorly on right-wingers, and that wouldn't be fair. That could be dangerous for them. No one would be arguing that. The standard has to be consistent. We either don't publish these things as a policy for the reasons that I just explained, or we do, because it's newsworthy. We don't pick and choose which manifestos get coverage and which don't based on the politics and how helpful it is to certain narratives. This should be obvious. But at, you know, these days, this day and age, apparently you have to say it clearly. Dan McLaughlin at National Review, making inarguably correct points earlier today, speaking of the LGBT groups and in their opposition to releasing the manifesto, he asks, why are these groups taking this stance? They are plainly afraid that it would be bad to use the shooter's words because this might cause people to blame other people who share some of the shooter's ideas. But this is exactly what these groups and their media advocates would be doing if the tables were turned. Every sentient adult knows that if a conservative, biblically orthodox Christian shot a transgender institution, these same people and groups would be pushing the press, who would not need pushing, to publish the manifesto, precisely so that they could discredit people who shared some of the shooter's ideas. No honest person could deny this, and I completely agree with him. It's obvious. He says what should happen in moments like this, number one, don't use the shooter's name. I agree. Two, don't quote the shooter's words. I think you can characterize them, not publishing or directly quoting. I think that's fair. Three, do not blame the victims. I can't believe that we have to say that, but we do. Especially when the victims are a disfavored group to the people who try to set our cultural norms in this country. Number four, do not generalize about people who share ideas, identity, or characteristics with the shooter, which is only fair. That's the point I've also been making. It's a standard of basic fairness and decency, frankly, that the left completely abandons almost to a person whenever possible, even when the facts don't align. But those seem like four very good principles from Dan McLaughlin at National Review. But he writes, if the media give in to these requests to censor this manifesto explicitly and specifically, only in this case, then turn around, as we all know they will, in future cases where there is a political benefit to the left. Well, we all know what they're doing, and we all know that the people making those decisions don't give a damn about the body count caused by encouraging more shooters to seek this kind of publicity. You need a consistent standard. It can't depend on the politics. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that's what we're going to see, because so much of the coverage in reaction to horrible events like this is explicitly, instantly, reflexively, aggressively, proudly, indignantly political. Like, it's go time for these people. And it's just interesting that when there is a blame game plus guns, that combination that they think benefits their cause, their agenda, they go all in on both. But when the blame game piece of it is not convenient for their agenda, it just vanishes into thin air. It's not something that they're interested in, and they go even harder, double, triple down on the gun stuff. Congressional Democrats had a press conference today where there was a podium on the Capitol steps right outside the House, a block or two from where I sit right now. And the placard on the podium said, what was it, kids over guns. Because, again, this is the message. If you oppose our ideas on restricting guns, you don't care about kids and you're okay with them being dead. And we addressed that quite pointedly here on the show yesterday. You can go back and hear the podcast if you want to. And someone pointed out that one of the most demagogic people is the new House Minority Leader. What's her name? Kathleen Clark from Massachusetts, who is going on about this stuff, whose own child is trans and was recently arrested for a violent attack on a police officer. And her message to America, the mother, is we're not allowed to talk about any of this other stuff that you people want to talk about. We're talking about guns and guns only. And if you disagree, then you don't care about the lives of kids. I mean, it's just grotesque. Two more quick points that I want to make here. We had a guest on the show yesterday, Paul Morrow, former NYPD inspector. He was talking about strengthening schools, armed, uniformed guards, perhaps retired police in schools. He was making the case in favor of that. I think it should be certainly discussed, if not actively pursued, as a part of a incomplete, imperfect solution to some of this stuff. And I got a few responses from you guys, direct messages on Instagram. We should probably set up like an email address for the show where people can write in. I think that'd be a good idea. But I heard from one listener who said, Guy, you were talking with a retired New York cop yesterday. He casually said something like, it's not like kids don't see cops on the street every day. He says, I'm a suburbanite. My kids don't see cops. They see cop cars on the highway, but we can easily go months without seeing anyone in uniform. I'm not disagreeing with hardening schools, just pointing out that the interviewee was giving a highly city-centric view. And I think that that's a fair point. Also, though, I think when you go to an airport, for example, kids see people in uniforms there for their security. After a traumatizing event, you know, security was overhauled after 9/11. I think kids can probably get used to that. And the question is, does the perhaps discomfort initially of having a new person armed in a uniform in your school, does that outweigh the possible benefit and even the sense of comfort that that person might bring? I mean, I know where I lean in that discussion. Had another listener send me this. Listening to yesterday's podcast, she sent me this morning. Want to give a perspective. I teach at a small private Christian school fairly close to Nashville. I have students who used to attend there, meaning Covenant. We have an armed security former sergeant who works at our school. He has an office. He's obviously armed. He plans our defensive plans, investigates incidents on campus if needed. He's not positioned at the door, just standing there with a gun. The kids love him. We are blessed to have him. Police officers tend to retire at younger ages, and many get another job or pursue a career. I imagine this would be great for so many schools instead of hiring poorly trained security guards. So that was just an experience at another private school in that state that does have armed security with it's a retired cop and the kids love him. I just want to throw that out there. I think that's interesting. Just adding it to the conversation, since I think conversations are good when we're trying to figure out tough problems together. We'll take a break. We'll come right back. It's the Guy Benson Show.
The Guy Benson Show. More next.
Back on the Guy Benson Show, we told you yesterday about that Senate staffer who worked for Rand Paul, works for Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, who was just stabbed in broad daylight. He was walking with a friend, 8th Street corridor. Someone came up and stabbed him in life-threatening wounds. We're learning more about the suspect who's been arrested, who was released from prison literally the day before the stabbing. Based on court documents, this person did not serve the entirety of a 12-year sentence. In fact, was released previously and violated his D.C. parole in September of 2021, was arrested in Chicago last February. And then went back to prison and was let out early. Despite getting released, violating parole, getting rearrested for something else in another state, then let out early, next day, stabbing Rand Paul's staffer in the streets of Washington, D.C. in the middle of the day. This suspect, listen to this rap sheet, 14 burglary and theft arrests, an illegal gun possession arrest, 2 auto theft arrests, 2 assault on police officer arrests, and a drug offense. That's what, 23 priors? Now he almost murdered someone. There was another story in the Washington Post today about how the vast majority of crimes in D.C. are not prosecuted. The city council chief was just on Capitol Hill or submitted testimony saying that there's no crime crisis in this city. I might get to that tomorrow. I want to spend some more time on that assertion. There's an update on that stabbing from a suspect who should be behind bars but isn't. On and on it goes in our nation's capital. Another hour coming up here.
From the most powerful city in the world. Unconventional talk from a fresh, unconventional conservative. Guy Benson Show.
It's a brand new hour on the Guy Benson Show in D.C. Thanks for being here. GuyBensonShow.com is our website. Podcast is always free, always on demand when the show is over. At Guy Benson Show on Twitter and Instagram. Fox News alert as we begin this second of 3 hours. The Dow closing up 323 points today, finishing up at 32,717. Joining us now here in studio in the Tony Snow Studios is U.S. Senator John Thune from South Dakota. He is the Senate Republican whip, the number two position among Senate Republicans, and it is great to see you. Thanks for being here.
And thanks. Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Guy.
I do have to ask you off the top, since you're the number two Republican in the Senate, the number one Republican in the Senate, Senator McConnell, had a tumble recently. He was in the hospital for a while. I've seen they've been updating us with statements. How is he doing?
He's doing well. I mean, he's recovering, and you know, we hope to have him back soon. He actually is in good spirits. I actually texted back and forth with him earlier today. And he's paying a lot of attention to what's going on, like he always does and like you would expect. And we're anxious to have him back, which I assume will be – we have a little break coming up here for the Easter holiday, and I assume he'll be back after that.
All right. Well, let's hope so. And we've been thinking of him and praying for him, and please give him our best. I also have to ask you this. You're a big hoops guy. Mm-hmm. In fact, we were just talking college hoops in the break. Do you have rooting interests ahead of the Final Four?
Mine kind of got shredded, like everybody else's.
Yeah. I had. You mean you didn't have a 4 seed and 2 5 seeds and a 9 seed in the Final Four?
No kidding. I actually have. I had Miami, so that's the only team I have.
That's
left
That's better
final
than
four.
Most people, though.
Yeah, I know.
They got UConn, though.
Well, even they, you know, they're using AI now to do this, artificial intelligence, and their bracket, I think, had Gonzaga, Texas. So we aren't, you know. AI isn't much better. Artificial intelligence isn't much better than our natural intelligence, evidently, on this.
We'll see how Miami deals with this buzzsaw of the Huskies. They've just been ridiculous.
They are really playing well.
They are. So we'll see what happens.
Good timing.
Let's talk about TikTok. It's a huge topic on the Hill. We saw the hearing over in the House last week. CEO sort of struggling to answer some of these questions, maybe not very persuasive in some of the other answers. I know he got a lot of skepticism, and I was happy to see from both sides of the aisle. This was not just right. Republicans saying boo and Democrats playing defense. It was actually a bipartisan effort. What do you make of what we saw last week, and what are you proposing on this issue?
Right. So nobody was – there. He didn't assuage anybody's concerns about the way that TikTok uses Americans' data, steals American data, manipulates the content that we see online. And so there was bipartisan, I think, I don't know if outrage is the right word, but at least desire to do something about it. And there are a number of ideas out there. We've got one, and I think it's one that makes a lot of sense. It codifies a Trump executive order from 2019, which basically would create a process whereby not only TikTok, but other forms of technologies, platforms, apps that are come into our country that are hosted by foreign adversaries would go through a process, a review process, where ultimately they could be banned, blocked, mitigated. But it's a rules-based approach. They tried to knock TikTok out back in 2020, and WeChat took a shot at both of them using executive orders, and both were knocked down by the court. So I think this is a process whereby we can actually get at this issue, and not just as it applies to TikTok, but also to other, you know, WeChat's another one. Kaspersky's a Russian platform. Obviously, we've dealt with Huawei in the past, technology that had Chinese components in our broadband networks, which we're now ripping and replacing. And I think we need a strategy and a plan in place for how to deal with this.
I have seen, and I'm in favor of either a full sale of TikTok where it has no Chinese CCP fingerprints anymore, or a ban. Yeah. I'm on board for that for various reasons. I have seen some conservatives sympathetic to those arguments saying this measure that you're talking about could be too broad and could be abused, saying, OK, the first right in front of us, the examples that you just gave, that makes sense. But how could this be perhaps misused often in the future? What do you make of some of those drawbacks, concerns that some people are raising?
Well, I mean, the legislation is pretty specific. It names six foreign adversary countries. And, so this would apply to those technologies. It would also require that a lot of the information that's used to evaluate whether or not their national security risk would be declassified. I think it's a very open process, the review process is. And I come back to the point is, it is a Trump EO. There was a Trump executive order in 2019, and this basically codifies that process. So it's something that we think works and would withstand a legal challenge. There are concerns about, because this was challenged in court before, it failed. The executive order was thrown out, bill of attainder issues, et cetera. We think the process we create, being rules based and not a single entity. We're not trying to knock out one company or one particular group, but it's focused on any of these threats, to include TikTok, but others as well, as we have to deal with them on a case-by-case basis.
You focus a lot on energy.
Right.
And have you seen the exchange between your colleague, Senator Hoeven, and Secretary Holland about American energy?
I haven't seen it yet, but I can imagine.
Let's listen to this. Okay. Cut 30.
Do you think it is better for our country to get oil and gas from federal lands in this country with our environmental standards, or is it better to get it from places like Venezuela, Russia, Middle East, and other places with vastly inferior environmental standards? Where would you prefer that oil and gas come from?
Senator, what I can say is that President Biden is dedicated and committed to making sure that we have an energy independent nation.
Well, but the response to my question, where would you prefer to get that oil and gas?
Our, as I mentioned many times, the oil production in this country is up on federal lands. We are doing, we're moving those permits through. We're doing our jobs. And I appreciate the question.
Yeah, she appreciates the question so much that she didn't answer it
right.
Twice. What do you make of that exchange? It's one of your Republican colleagues and then cabinet secretary in the Biden administration.
Yeah, and she's been a disaster as a secretary there. Came in with an agenda, really fits the current administration's agenda. But, they're at a loss to explain why We can't produce American energy, and why we have to rely on these other countries around the world. They don't have a good answer for it because there is no good answer for it. And if anything that the war in Ukraine has taught us is this overdependence upon countries like Russia for energy. We've seen that in Europe, and it should be a very direct and harsh reminder to Americans that we need an all-of-the-above American energy plan. We ought to be producing it here at home. As Senator Hovind pointed out, we produce it in the most environmentally sensible, friendly way possible, and we lessen that dangerous dependence that we have on other countries around the world.
And by the way, if she says that Biden's dedicated to making sure that we have an energy-independent nation, which I think is disputable, but
right.
That's what she's saying in her answer, and that, oh, you know, they love boasting in these very sort of narrow cherry-picked statistics about how things are actually up and drilling permits are up or whatever. They've got all their talking points. Ignore all the other stuff that they're doing. If that's the message that she's trying to deliver in a meaningful way, it really shouldn't be a trick question. Would you prefer that we get our own resources from our own soil or go to these other hostile, you know, dirtier environmentally countries? I mean, it's an easy answer that for some reason was not given.
Yeah, well, it is a kind of a zero-sum game, really. I mean, I don't think it shouldn't be complicated for anybody. I do think that this administration, because of their ESG agenda, environment, social governance agenda, is overly focused on forms of energy that, you know, frankly, they funded a lot of in the Inflation Reduction Act, so much so that the Wall Street Journal had an editorial earlier this week that said the cost of those policies is going to be triple.
3X.
3X of what they were talking about.
Surprise!
You're shocked. And you know, and yet you can't – they'll say we've opened up leases, but they're not allowing permits to drill. They have environmental processes that take forever to get through. And so permitting reform is something that we've talked about, and we're actually – the House Republicans are talking about that as a possibility for a conversation with the White House about
– the debt ceiling.
The debt ceiling. So
what do you think of that? That's my next question on the debt ceiling.
Well,
I was asked about it on a special report this week.
Yeah.
What do you make of what's happening? It seems like nothing's really happening, and Republicans – whether you like it or not, are going to have to come to the table with a unified proposal, which could be hard.
Right.
Unity within the party sometimes is hard. But you can't really have an effective negotiation against the Dems if the Republicans aren't on the same page. Is permitting reform the answer to that?
I think it could be. And I think, you know, they filed their bill, H.R. 1, this week, which is a broader energy bill to include permitting reform. But I do think that's something that perhaps could be on the table. The administration is trying to run the clock out. They don't want to talk about the debt ceiling. They don't talk about spending reforms. They don't want to talk about policy changes. They just want to keep status quo. So House Republicans are really going to have to press the issue. And I think it's important that we do agree on you know, a handful of issues. I think energy's in there. Like I said, permitting reform, work requirements under some of the federal programs, I think is something that would yield, you know, tremendous savings down the road. And, you know, at least clawing back some of the unspent COVID funds would be another thing that we ought to be able to agree on.
And do we maybe get movement on this before May or June, or is that too crazy?
Well, it would
in
be
D.C.?
Great. I think that the administration, like I said, they're going to try and run the clock out and scare people.
Yeah. We'll see if it works.
We'll see if it
works.
Hopefully it won't. We got to get to the table.
Senator John Thune of South Dakota, our guest on the Guy Benson Show here in studio. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Thanks, Guy.
We'll be right back after this. I'm Guy Benson. We're back. It's been a minute, but it's time, again, for Woke Tales.
Woke Tales. Woo!
We have been covering some of the absolute insanity at some of our nation's quote-unquote elite law schools in recent months. We did a couple segments on Georgetown Law and the madness there. We have done multiple segments over multiple days about the incident at Stanford Law School. How about Columbia Law School getting in on the action? This story from the Daily Wire. Columbia University law students and alums threw a tantrum over the mere mention of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh on a school Instagram post, with students calling him a rapist as administrators egged them on. The incident, which followed a similar outburst at Stanford University's School of Law, raises questions about whether high-priced elite law schools are infantilizing people in their 20s and 30s and turning them into hardcore radicals with dubious grasp of the law and inability to even be near people with differing opinions. The outrage was over Columbia Law School simply noting on an Instagram post that some students who were part of the Federalist Society, had gone to D.C. and spoken with Kavanaugh about the practice of law. Virtually all of the school's many race-based groups said they will refuse to help the school recruit diverse students because of the post. Quote, "We believe that our school's choice to platform Justice Kavanaugh is symbolic of a pattern of behavior that our organization does not and will not support and will not be affiliated with," the Black Law Students Association wrote. "We thank LALSA, NALSA, EWOC, Outlaws, QTPOC, If When How, APLSA, SALSA, and others, all these alphabet soup of diversity groups, for joining us in this advocacy and struggle. We look forward to continued collaboration. By joining us in this effort, you have all helped us put the administration on notice that we have a strong and growing collective," it added. The law school's Empowering Women of Color group said it was, quote, "withdrawing our participation from Columbia Law School recruiting events as a result of the post, demanding that, quote, it is time for Columbia Law School to sharpen its politics. We cannot condone complicity with a man who is credibly accused of sexual assault," it wrote. Luke Cronin, who is an editor of Columbia Law Review, commented on the school's Instagram post, "Kavanaugh sexually violated Dr. Ford." Okay. It would be kind of funny if it weren't so scary. These are the Ivy League lawyers and judges and politicians of tomorrow. They are there to study the law, and yet many of them just take as gospel the notion that Brett Kavanaugh is a rapist or a sexual assailant, even though there is absolutely no evidence that Brett Kavanaugh ever met his accuser. And we've talked about all of the evidence or lack thereof many times here. You can go back and read my stuff on it. None whatsoever. The key witness of Dr. Ford and Dr. Ford's father have both subsequently come out and said they don't believe her. The witness against Kavanaugh, this friend of Dr. Ford's in high school, said that the only thing that was relevant to her that happened over the course of that attempted witch trial was that she was coerced and bullied and pressured to lie and change her story to hurt Kavanaugh. And here we have Columbia Law, because some right-leaning students went to D.C. and met with a Supreme Court justice, and the school highlighted that fact on Instagram, an absolute meltdown among the students and a lot of faculty, because Brett Kavanaugh cannot be platformed or seen in any sort of even neutral way on an Instagram post, Columbia Law School. These groups called it terrifying. What absolute baby lunatics these people are. And their punishment for the school is, oh, you're going to post Brett Kavanaugh without calling him a rapist? Guess what? We're not going to help you recruit people of our various minority categories that these affinity groups exist to supposedly serve. Now, if you don't agree with them, obviously, you can get the hell out right away. That's their version of tolerance. But this is what they're doing. They're insisting that Columbia, a very left-wing place, get even more explicitly left-wing as a matter of policy. These places have become absolutely nuts. They are out of their minds. And the complete lack of caring, the complete disinterest in standards of evidence is disturbing given the fact that it's a law school. The whole thing should be about the law, the even application of the law. And they obviously don't care. It is politics first above everything else, politics and identity. And then the law stuff is like some weird afterthought. That's what they're producing in these places. One other note, somewhat related, at George Mason University in Virginia, students are demanding, I should put it this way, some students are demanding that the university disinvite the commencement speaker, Glenn Youngkin, the governor of the state. The whole song and dance, don't platform, blah, blah, blah. I saw that the group Fire came out in defense of the school, and against censorship. I saw some sort of willfully obtuse leftists expressing confusion about what constitutes censorship. If you're telling the school that you must disinvite someone, deplatform an invited speaker, that would be censorship. That would be advocating for censorship. because you don't like whatever this person might say and your feelings are hurt, that is not a good thing. That is an illiberal tantrum. So far, it seems the school is holding these people at bay. I'm sure there are plenty of students at George Mason who would love to hear from Governor Youngkin. Also, last point, if you are such an infant that you cannot handle the idea of sharing the same oxygen with Glenn Youngkin, and hearing some of his words, you need to get a grip. But a lot of these people at a lot of these places do not have a grip. And the culture is to not have a grip and be as unhinged and deranged as possible at all times. Politics, identity first, everything else second, third, or irrelevant. Not great. More Woke Tales after this.
Talking about the issues you care about, Guy Benson.
Halfway through the broadcast week on this Wednesday, halfway through the show, thanks for being here, GuyBensonShow.com, podcast free every day. But we started it in the last segment. We're going to keep it rolling. Hit the jingle, Woke Tales.
Woke Tales, woo!
Now, to say that we're late to this story would be an understatement. It happened in 2021, but it escaped my attention completely. I had no idea that this happened. It was brought to my attention very recently, posted about it at townhall.com, and part of the reason that I'm interested in it generally is because there's a personal component for me. Back in fifth grade, now prepare yourselves for this, back in the fifth grade, I won my school's geography bee. That's right. Circa 1995, I was the Ridge School Elementary Geography King. Yes, please, please hold your applause. I know you're very impressed. My winning answer, in case you were curious, was Indonesia. Take that, Alexis. Runner up. In any case, love geography, grew up overseas, spent a lot of time as a kid overseas, so enjoyed looking at maps, reading maps, learning countries, that kind of thing. My skills have slipped. My memory is not as good as it was on all those little facts, but as a fifth grader, I was super into it. And I always dreamed of being on that Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego PBS show, right, with Rocapella, making it to the final round where you could run across the map of the world and put little police siren lights on the correct answer and try to win a free trip to somewhere. Oh, yeah. I was all about that as a kid. And the Holy Grail is the National Geographic Geography Bee, which had been happening for decades. I say had been happening because this is what I just learned a few days ago. Writer Zaid Jilani pointed this out. The National Geographic Geography Bee was canceled in 2020 due to COVID, like everything else. And then in the following year, 2021, it was permanently canceled. Why was it permanently canceled? That seems a bit extreme. I get it. In 2020, things were postponed, but you pick things back up when life gets back to normal. But they decided, no, this needs to go away forever. Here's their press release about it back in 2021. Again, I did not hear about this or see this at the time, but it makes me so upset that I'm raising it now. Quote, the National Geographic Society is deeply proud of the 33-year legacy of the GOB and the millions of students, educators, parents, schools, and others who have participated in this iconic competition. In 2020, recognizing the difficult circumstances school communities found themselves in due to safety to safely educate students during the COVID-19 pandemic, we made the difficult decision to cancel the 2020-2021 GOB and instead focus on reimagining what a global geography experience for young people could look like entirely. After many conversations and reflections with students, educators, and community members, we've made the decision to permanently discontinue the National Geographic GOB to make way for new, transformative, and innovative geography education opportunities in which students around the globe can more equitably participate. There is a frequently asked question portion of this press release. One of the questions was, why did the National Geographic Society choose to permanently discontinue the GOB? So they say it again, how proud they are of the legacy, 33 years. So very proud. So proud. But not proud enough to keep it going. Because, quote, in addition to the drop in GOB registration in 2020, it's because of the pandemic, by the way, not lack of interest, important shifts from COVID-19 to an increased focus on racial injustice challenged us to find new, transformative, meaningful ways to engage young people globally in geography. So they permanently canceled the Geography Bee for vague reasons involving equity and racial injustice. That's incredible. Zaid Jilani, the aforementioned writer, he points out that over the last decade, before this thing got axed, almost all of the winners of these Geography Bees were Asian. And as we've seen with the woke crowd, Asians sometimes count as people of color, sometimes not. Sometimes they're white supremacy adjacent when that talking point is useful. When it's useful to categorize them as people of color, then they do so. The rules always change, right? It's always about politics first. Remember that. That's how it works. So it seems, now they don't say this explicitly, although the words equity and racial injustice sort of give the game away, they decided that the competition was somehow not aligning with equity and was not furthering the push for an increased focus on racial injustice, and therefore the Geography Bee had to go away forever. And Jilani suggests completely plausibly that one of the big reasons is that the people who were winning the bee had the wrong skin color, ethnicity, background. A little too many of those types winning. How not equitable is that? Now, you wonder if it were other skin types, skin hues, ethnic identities that were dominating the competition, would we have the opposite here? Would we have people touting how well this group of people were doing in this area of passion? I guarantee you the whole thing wouldn't be canceled forever. So here you have a bunch of adults. I know they had difficult conversations in these little bubble, rarefied air, left-wing elite circles where they basically sit around and the conclusion is already made. They just all have to vigorously agree with each other that, sadly, this multi-decade tradition must go away. And we consulted with difficult conversations, but, you know, equity and injustice, sorry. They had these adults at National Geographic basically saying, sorry, kiddos, you've got to equity away this thing that you're good at and work really hard on. Unspoken, your racial, ethnic backgrounds are kind of a problem. Representation or something. Thanks for the memories, though. Super proud. It's actually sick. Think about the kids like me who are so passionate about this and a lot better at it than I was, who pour a lot of their effort into this as a huge extracurricular activity, something that keeps them engaged and excited and driving toward a goal and striving for excellence. And a bunch of adults decided too many of them looked too similar, so the whole thing had to go. And here's just some flowery, BS, meaningless language with some buzzwords in it to justify. So maybe you knew that this happened 2 years ago. I did not. But in case you didn't know, now you do. National Geographic decided that the Geography Bee was just too inequitable and not quite focused enough on racial injustice, so it is a thing of the past. And if you were a child disappointed by that, this decision being made by people much older than you for absolutely no reason, well, tough luck. They tell us this is progress, by the way. This is what progress supposedly looks like. And we wonder why we're heading the direction that we are as a society with these types of things happening. Here's another one, courtesy of CNN. And I went back to check this actually today to make sure that I wasn't imagining this. Because I don't think this was an opinion piece at CNN. No, this was a news analysis at CNN. Happened last week. We meant to get to it, but news cycle's been a little busy. There was a deep dive, an explainer, a news analysis of the very dangerous phenomenon known as digital blackface. So blackface, you know what blackface is, right? Prime Minister of Canada, former Democratic governor of Virginia. That's blackface. And it's very controversial. We've seen networks and entertainment companies go back and delete and censor entire episodes of shows where blackface was portrayed, even in a negative light or in a humorous light, making fun of people who would wear blackface. The context didn't matter, right? The context never matters to them, right? Intent, context, no, we just have to not just condemn it, but erase it from memory. My friend Megyn Kelly was fired, ostensibly. They were looking for a reason. But she was fired at NBC for commenting on blackface in a way that was deemed in that moment not appropriate by a network, NBC, that a few years earlier had a major primetime comedy show with a whole blackface plotline. They put blackface on NBC. Of course, they've since memory-holed that. Wasn't that long before Megyn Kelly said something about blackface and she got fired. So now this is a new version. This is called digital blackface, which apparently involves white people posting memes and GIFs of people of color in a way that I guess they're now arguing amounts to a digital form, a virtual form of blackface. And here's how the story goes, this deep analysis from CNN, chasing down the real important stories. Number one, trusted name of news? Facts are facts, something like that. Facts first. Apples are apples, oranges are bananas, or whatever. Whatever their big push. Maybe they have an explainer at CNN Plus. Speaking of memory hold. Quote, perhaps you posted that meme of supermodel Tyra Banks exploding in anger on America's Next Top Model. Or maybe you simply posted popular GIFs, such as the one of NBA great Michael Jordan crying. Or drag queen RuPaul declaring, girl, if you're black and you've shared such images online, you get a pass. But if you're white, you may have inadvertently perpetuated one of the most insidious forms of contemporary racism. Digital blackface. It's a practice where white people co-opt online expressions of black imagery, slang, catchphrases, or culture to convey comic relief or express emotions. These expressions, what one commentator calls racialized reactions, are mainstays in Twitter feeds, TikTok videos, Instagram reels, are among the most popular internet memes available. Digital blackface involves white people play-acting at being black, says Lauren Michael Jackson, author and cultural critic. Thank God for people like Lauren. She has an essay for Teen Vogue where she is bemoaning digital blackface. Speaking on behalf of people of color, she says, we are your sass, your nonchalance, your fury, your delight, your annoyance, your happy dance, your diva, your shade, your yass moments. The weight of reaction gifting, period, rests on our shoulders. This is like a real thing that this person wrote at Teen Vogue, that august publication. It was so important that CNN decided this needs to be a news analysis. Let's quote, dear Lauren Michelle Jackson. Did I say Michael before? Lauren Michelle Jackson. The CNN piece goes on, in trying to define digital blackface, it depends on who you talk to. Well, the standard for some is comparable to what one Supreme Court justice once said when asked his test for pornography. I know it when I see it. Even with that definition, it's hard to figure out exactly what is and what isn't digital blackface. There's dilemmas all around, guys. This is the challenge that Elizabeth Helfer faces. Here's another important face, I believe a white face in this case, in the CNN story. She's a brand designer. She wrote an apologetic essay in 2020 about how she made a meme out of someone saying, "Ain't nobody got time for that." It's another catchphrase, another big internet meme. She said, "I've engaged," this is the big, you know, apologetic, self-flagellating, prostrating herself essay. "I've engaged in digital blackface," Halford wrote. She says, if she refrains from using any black memes, she runs into a different problem, though. Quote, "Those are the most effective because white people are so boring," which is, oh, you know, racism. But, well, you know, it's fine. She's just insulting white people. It's fine. So just be on the lookout. Bolo, folks. Bolo. If there's a GIF or a meme that involves someone who's not white and you're white, ooh, it might be one of the most insidious forms of racism to retweet that or post it. Just for fun, in a way that people find enjoyable and humorous. By the way, as ridiculous as all of this is, number one, it really detracts from actual racism, which still exists. But also, if this is deemed one of the most insidious new forms of racism that's out there, it's indicative of how much progress we've made. Because you've got a bunch of busybody grievance mongers plumbing the depths and scraping the bottom of the barrel with this absolute nonsense. Digital blackface. You can't make it up, but you can read all about it in a serious, crucial news analysis over at CNN. A little bit more woke tales on the other side of this break. Stay tuned.
The Guy Benson Show. More next.
We're back. It's the Guy Benson Show. One last segment this hour, one last opportunity for woke tales.
Woke tales. Woo!
Three times in an hour. Excessive, but exciting. So we told you about the Wall Street Journal poll that just came out on social issues and culture. And one of the questions was about trans athletes and participation in sports and who should be allowed to compete against whom. And I think you can be completely tolerant and kind toward trans people and also say people born biologically male with some of the physical advantages that comes with that should not compete against biological females. Now, that's very controversial in a place like Twitter and in the mainstream media, but out in reality, the vast majority of Americans agree with what I just said. In fact, only 17% of those polled said that trans people should just be able to pick whoever they compete against. 17%. Almost all of whom apparently are like active Twitter users and journalists and elected Democrats. That's about it. NPR, a few days ago, had a story about one of the top sports organizations in track and field making the decision that, in fact, people who were born male and were male through puberty cannot compete against women. And in an effort to dunk on that, NPR said that this decision was made despite, quote, limited scientific evidence that men have a physical advantage over women. And it's just so ridiculous on its face, this misappropriation of the science, which is just wrong. Eventually, they had to correct and take that down, just embarrassing themselves. Oh, and by the way, ESPN did a big Celebrating Women's History Month push, and one of the highlighted women worthy of celebration is, of course, Leah Thomas, the now female swimmer who was a mediocre male swimmer and is now like a world beater as a woman. So, you know, ESPN, part of that 17% along with NPR, and then everyone else is like, hey, we can be kind to folks and affirm people's dignity and also not do this craziness and not endorse this unfairness. Yet more fodder for woke tales. Let's wrap it up.
Woke tales. Woo!
Final hour of the Guy Benson Show. Straight ahead, Carol Markowitz is here. Stay tuned.
It's 5 o'clock in the most powerful city in the world, Washington, D.C. It's time for the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour, sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage has come to America. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a Happy Hour on the Guy Benson Show, Wednesday edition. Thank you for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast is always free on demand if you can't listen as we air. That's GuyBensonShow.com or FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social, where we add little nuggets and goodies from time to time, bonus content, at Guy Benson Show on Twitter and on Instagram. My handle, both places, personally, is at Guy P. Benson. This hour is sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink. Absolutely delicious. Strongly recommend if you're 21 plus only. Always drink responsibly. Log on to thelongdrink.com. You can see where they're sold near you. Big expansion. You can also order online. Thelongdrink.com. We are very happy to welcome back now to the show Carol Markowitz, columnist at the New York Post and FoxNews.com, co-author with Bethany Mandel of the new book Stolen Youth, How Radicals Are Erasing Innocence and Indoctrinating a Generation. Carol, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Guy. Always so good to be on with you.
So I just want to ask you about this. It made a bit of a stir, a week or two ago. Your co-author, our friend Bethany, was on a morning show, and you guys run yourselves ragged promoting the book. She was a little tired. She had this memory blank for a second when a liberal host was trying to get her to define wokeness, and she just drew a blank. It happens to the best of us. And that went all over the place. And leftists were sort of like, look, even these conservatives have no idea what wokeness is. They just rail against this thing that doesn't exist. They can't even define it. And of course, Bethany more than capably defined it when she had a second to put her thoughts together. But in that moment, it was like this gotcha that rocketed all over the place. I just wonder what that experience was like for you guys. It gave a lot of publicity to the book, first of all. It also gave many opportunities for both of you to talk about the very real phenomenon of wokeness. And I also think it is important for conservatives to have a good sense of what that term means, so it doesn't just apply way too much to all sorts of things, because I think it is important to focus our attention on certain problems. Just talk us through that whole episode.
Yeah. So the first thing that, you know, it's so funny because the second I heard that, I mean, I've heard Bethany define wokeness a million times.
Of course.
But the first thing that I thought of when I saw that was that I had been on the Guy Benson Show when the book was first announced, and I forgot the name of the book. And the crazy thing is, I was holding the book in my hand. I literally was on your show, and I said, the name of the book is I just blanked, and I'm holding the book in my hand. I could just look down and read it, but no, I decided to stammer through, and I don't know if you remember this or whatever, but I remember it because it was the longest 10 seconds of my life where I couldn't remember the book that I had just written. And it happens. It happens. Brain spasms happen like that. And because Bethany and I had been talking about it so much, and because I know that she had talked about it, written about it, obviously she knows what it means. She knows how to describe it. She just got caught in a moment of, you know, not remembering. And it was obviously difficult for her. You know, people on the internet, not that nice, believe it or not.
Oh, I've heard.
We both got just a barrage of just the worst comments in the world. And, you know, for me, I don't know, I'm very big on blocking and muting, and I just delete. Like, you can leave me a 3-page, you know, essay on my Instagram of how much you hate me, and it's going to take me 1 second to delete it. So just, you know, use your time wisely. But, yeah, it was not great. But I think she just shone that through the whole thing, and she handled it very graciously. She took responsibility for not knowing the answer.
Oh yeah, she like immediately
did great.
Came right back, and like, she is not someone who is able to be rattled or bullied long term. That's just not in her DNA.
And she, you know, she retweeted the video. She was like, look what happened. This is what happened. Let me tell you. She also said that the host of that show was on a hot mic in the minutes before the interview began, saying how much she hates parents and how parents are just the worst. And Bethany, who has 6 children, including a newborn, by the way, when I had a newborn, I was not doing any radio or TV or any touring for a book. My brain was mush for all 3 of my kids. So the fact that she, you know, heard this anti-parent conversation going on, she was rattled, and this was the result.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the fact that she's then had the opportunity to talk a lot about it and also promote the book, and also, I think, over and over again, disprove, because the thesis that they're trying to draw or derive from that one little brief brain fart was, this is all a made-up thing. And the right-wingers are sort of conjuring this out of their fever swamps because they want to rail against some enemy that doesn't really exist. And look, when you call them on it, they can't even define it. Of course, your book, the whole purpose of Stolen Youth, is to chronicle many, many, many verifiable examples of wokeness being inflicted on children. Here's just another one, and this is when Mary Catherine and Ham and I wrote End of Discussion. We just joked that ever since, for years, there's just been basically daily updates where we could just keep writing sequels and then, you know, a follow-up book because it never ends. Here's a new example from the New York Post. The teachers' union in New York City now sponsoring a virtual workshop on fighting back against, quote, the harmful effects of whiteness in our lives. That's the teachers' union in New York City, the city that you loved, the city that you left for all sorts of different reasons. It's basically saying, look at all this harm being done by whiteness. That's an official thing that educators are being exposed to in New York. And obviously the point is to have this not just trickle down, but be force-fed down to students. I mean, you can say wokeness isn't a thing. Then you read a story like that. We just did a whole almost hour of woke tales right before you came on, Carol. This stuff is inescapable. It's everywhere.
So I reread your book before writing our book because I thought that, you know, I remember I read it at the time, obviously, but I just reread it because I really think that the origins of wokeness and what we have going on right now, it takes place in your book where you're not allowed to talk about certain things. It's a forced conformity. So when people ask me what is wokeness, I often say it's leftism. Yes, absolutely. But it's coupled with a forced conformity where you're not allowed to speak up and say this is crazy because how could white teachers in New York City be given this kind of, you know, conference or a panel or whatever and not be able to speak up and say, this is crazy. I'm not doing this. But they don't and they can't because they are afraid for their jobs or they're afraid for their social standing or they're afraid to be targeted by the left who does not allow anybody to step out of line. So End of Discussion for me is the beginning of this woke journey that our country has been on where you're not allowed to debate anything and the discussion ends when they say it does.
Well, I have to say, Carol, even though last time, and I completely forgot that this even happened, but even though last time you forgot the name of your own book, the fact that you remember the name of my book and just plugged it is very much appreciated. End of Discussion, by the way, available on Amazon still. All these years later, sadly, extremely relevant, if not almost quaint at this point. Carol, another element of this is the indoctrination in schools. And I saw actually a chyron on MSNBC yesterday, and I took a photo of it. It was on here in the studio, and it was Nicole Wallace's left-wing show. And their featured guest was Randy Weingarten, of course. And the graphic at the bottom of the screen said, breaking news, Republicans move culture war fight to the classroom. And this is what the left, many activists on the left, believe and what journalists also believe because they are themselves left-wing activists and want average people, including parents, to believe that in the realm of indoctrination or culture wars, it is the Republicans who are doing it and the Republicans and conservatives who are targeting kids. And the point that I made on Fox News Sunday, because we were talking about the parental rights bill that just passed the House of Representatives and Democrats were setting themselves on fire, saying this is book banning and cruel and anti-child and all this stuff. And you actually read what's in the bill. It's just not even close to the reality of it. I said, no, what's happening is the culture war aggressors, not always, but most of the time these days, are leftists. And then conservatives notice that these things are happening. They push back in a way that is completely mainstream and would have been almost unanimously unobjectionable even a few years ago. And then somehow the gaslighting starts saying, oh, well, look at these culture warriors waging a culture war for noticing our culture war and objecting to it. I mean, it's sort of quite backwards. I wonder if it's successful or is it like sort of an echo chamber thing?
That's what happens. It's like conservatives are constantly on the defensive, and not just conservatives. I mean, I hear from moderates and liberals all the time now because it's gotten so bad that they're like, wait, why are drag queen story hours the number one story in the country? Like, why are we constantly hearing about new drag queen story hours? And of course, the funny thing is, when is the last time that any of these drag queen shows for kids that we've seen videos of, when's the last time we saw anybody reading a book in those shows? That's completely gone now too. It's become like drag queen stripper hours. And the thing is that like You know, that's actually a perfect example. Before this all began, I love drag queen shows. I'm all about, like, drag queen shows. You go ahead and do it. What does it have
to do? You like it better than I do. I mean, I'm not even that into it, but if you're an adult and you like it, go for it.
Like, it was fun.
Oh, no, I get it. I've been to a few. It's just not my thing. But, like, people find it fun. The people who do drag, the people who consume drag, the sort of sexualized joking and sort of the plays on words and then the performance. It's a whole campy thing. And if that's what you like and you're an adult, go for it. Knock yourself out. Have the best time. Do your drag brunch every single day of the week. Fine. There's a difference between that and, like, clearly sexualized stuff for kids. I saw a video of, like, a 12 or 13-year-old performing in drag in a very sexualized way in this, like, weird leather black outfit with a bunch of adults hooting and hollering, and I'm like, this is really disturbing. And they tell us, wow, that's pretty culture warrior of you to notice that and to say it's maybe a problem.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, you're not allowed to point out that nobody cared about drag queens at all until they started having children in their acts. And why? Why is this being aimed at kids at all? Why are kids the target audience for drag shows? Like, why is this happening? And there's so many other examples of this. Like, for a long time, parents didn't care what was in the school libraries until they started discovering porn. And now it's like, yeah, now we care. Now we're paying attention. And we're not supposed to be paying attention.
Oh, but that's book banning. Carol, excuse me, I have to fact check you. It's the Associated Press style guide now.
Right.
Graphic pornography for kids in schools being taken out of a school library, that is book banning, Carol, and it's very fascist.
It's wild that, and that's why I'm telling you that I hear from liberal and moderate parents all the time saying, I don't want this either, because there are very few parents that would defend this kind of material in school libraries. And the ones that do end up defending it are, they're doing so because they want to be part of the in-group. And the in-group says, the leftist in-group says that this is what we believe now. We believe that these books are good. We believe the drag shows for kids are okay. This is what we do now. And if you don't do this with us, you're in the out-group. And they don't want to be in the out-group. And that's literally what is happening across our country.
All right, Carol, hold that thought, because when we come back, I want to address something related. Randy Weingarten, still on my mind. There's some sound I want to play for you. Get your reaction right after this with Carol Markowitz on The Guy Benson Show.
Fresh conservative talk. Guy Benson Show.
Back on the happy hour on The Guy Benson Show with Carol Markowitz, our guest, author of the book Stolen Youth, along with Bethany Mandel. And right before the break, I mentioned Randy Weingarten. Here is a soundbite of her this week talking about how school choice, and there was an amazing school choice bill just signed into law a few days ago by Governor DeSantis, your new governor down in Florida. And, I mean, that is a sweeping piece of legislation. That's great news. And it looks like Georgia and Texas might be next, God willing. I think that's really exciting. Of course, she's losing her mind because the adult-driven, selfish monopoly of teachers' unions is what she's about. She's not about kids. She's not about teaching. She's not about education. She's not about learning. She's not about any of that. She's about selfish political interests of adults. So obviously, she's looking on at this school choice revolution, and she's deeply, deeply offended by it. And here's how she described it in Cut 28.
In good times and bad, public schools are cornerstones of our community, of our democracy, of our economy, of our nation. But some people want that cornerstone to crumble, and they're wielding sledgehammers. Attacks on public education are not new. The difference today is that the attacks are intended to destroy it, to make it a battlefield, a political cudgel.
I mean, her distress is like giving me life. I love hearing her this upset because she should be and she deserves it. But, I mean, Carol, and she goes on to talk about this as being targeted at the people who have the most meager resources available in their schools. They're trying to destroy public education. Here's the thing, Carol. No one's trying to destroy public education. You know this as well as I do. We have talked about examples. There were some up in Baltimore, some in Chicago that we were just recently talking about, where there are dozens of schools without a single child performing at grade level, not one in these schools. And what conservatives say, and actually some liberals too, which is good, they say parents and kids stuck in those failures should have other options like rich people do. And there's a way to do this, and providing money, not to these school systems, but to the families and the kids to make sure they can get educated. And what Randy Weingarten says is, no, only rich people get school choice. These kids have to stay stuck in those failing schools, or else we're destroying public education. How much more destruction can there be based on some of the outcomes that people like Randy Weingarten defend every single day?
So first of all, no one has destroyed public schools more than Randy Weingarten. When she kept schools closed for so long during the pandemic, in places where she had influence, she did untold damage. And I know everybody, now that we're moving, you know, it's 2023, where this is all in the rear view, and everybody just imagines that this only happened in the year 2020 to 2021. I remember in summer 2021, Randy Weingarten trying to keep schools closed in Florida. She was pushing that Florida public schools wouldn't open the following school year. So if Randy Weingarten wants to see who destroyed public schools in America, take a good look in the mirror, because it was you. And she did the most. Nobody did more for school choice and school vouchers than Randy Weingarten by making this so. And you're absolutely right. She wants only rich kids to have an exit. And I don't want to give up on public schools. I know a lot of conservatives believe school choice is the end-all be-all and that's it. But most kids go to their local public school. So to me, we need to fight for those schools, because people like Randy Weingarten are pushing these insane leftist agendas in them. And, you know, yes, maybe we'll someday get to the point where every kid who wants to get out of these schools, or these indoctrination factories, has an option to. But until we do, we have to fight for those schools too. So she's wrong. I don't want to destroy public schools. And, you know, as Corey DeAngelis always says, why would giving people a choice destroy public schools?
Well, she actually argued that, and she published some ridiculous piece saying, well, look, the data and the science shows that actually the public schools are best performing and kids are best in public schools. It's like, well, okay, if you believe that, first of all, why don't you force all of your rich Democrat, liberal, limousine liberal friends to send their kids to public school, see how much they'll go along with that. Spoiler alert, many of them will absolutely never agree to that, point one. Point two, if it was just empirically better based on science, people would make the choice happily to send their kids to the public schools and to stay in public schools. Weirdly, a lot of people aren't making that choice while denying other choices to other people. She is self-defeating in so many things that she does and says, which is why, in my own special way, I love her so much, because she is a very useful face of the opposition when it comes to this civil rights issue, where she is on the wrong side of history, to borrow a term that they love to use over there. We've got to stop and pause for a break, Carol, but we do appreciate your time as always. Your book, just as a reminder, is entitled Stolen Youth. People can get it everywhere. I do recommend it strongly. You can also read Carol's stuff in the New York Post, FoxNews.com. Always enjoy it, Carol. Come back soon.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to a new generation of talk, Guy Benson.
Earlier in the program today, here on The Guy Benson Show, we interviewed U.S. Senator John Thune, a Republican from South Dakota, part of the Republican leadership in the upper chamber. Here's part of my conversation with Senator Thune. TikTok, it's a huge topic on the Hill. We saw the hearing over in the House last week. CEO sort of struggling to answer some of these questions, maybe not very persuasive in some of the other answers. I know he got a lot of skepticism, and I was happy to see from both sides of the aisle. This was not just right. Republicans saying boo and Democrats playing defense. It was actually a bipartisan effort. What do you make of what we saw last week? And what are you proposing on this issue?
Right. So nobody was there. He didn't assuage anybody's concerns about the way that TikTok uses Americans' data, steals American data, manipulates the content that we see online. And so there was bipartisan, I think, I don't know if outrage is the right word, but at least desire to do something about it. And there are a number of ideas out there. We've got one, and I think it's one that makes a lot of sense. It codifies a Trump executive order from 2019, which basically would create a process whereby not only TikTok, but other forms of technologies, platforms, apps that are come into our country that are hosted by foreign adversaries would go through a process, a review process, where ultimately they could be banned, blocked, mitigated. but it's a rules-based approach. They tried to knock TikTok out back in 2020, and WeChat took a shot at both of them using executive orders, and both were knocked down by the court. So I think this is a process whereby we can actually get at this issue, and not just as it applies to TikTok, but also to other. You know, WeChat's another one. Kaspersky's a Russian platform. Obviously, we've dealt with Huawei in the past, technology that had Chinese components in our broadband networks, which we're now ripping and replacing. And I think we need a strategy and a plan in place for how to deal with this.
I have seen, and I'm in favor of either a full sale of TikTok where it has no Chinese CCP fingerprints anymore, or a ban. Yeah. I'm on board for that for various reasons. I have seen some conservatives sympathetic to those arguments saying this measure that you're talking about could be too broad and could be abused, saying, OK, the first right in front of us, the examples that you just gave, that makes sense. But how could this be perhaps misused often in the future? What do you make of some of those drawbacks, concerns that some people are raising?
Well, I mean, the legislation is pretty specific. It names six foreign adversary countries. And, you know, so this would apply to those technologies. It would also require that a lot of the information that's used to evaluate whether or not their national security risk would be declassified. I think it's a very open process. The review process is, and I come back to the point, is it is a Trump EO. There was a Trump executive order in 2019, and this basically codifies that process. So it's something that we think works and would withstand a legal challenge. There are concerns about, because this was challenged in court before, and you know, it failed, the executive order was thrown out, bill of attainder issues, et cetera. We think the process we create, being rules-based and, you know, not a single entity. We're not trying to knock out one company or, you know, one particular group, but it's focused on any of these threats, to include TikTok, but others as well, as we have to deal with them on a case-by-case basis.
My full interview with Senator John Thune, South Dakota, available at GuyBensonShow.com. Also on our free podcast, the whole show, start to finish, every day on demand for free, GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we return, it's the home stretch. There's a big event in Cookie's household this coming weekend. She is running around preparing for it. I hear it might be a bit much. We'll get those details as soon as we come back.
For the full interview and more, go to GuyBensonShow.com.
Home stretch on this Wednesday. It's the Guy Benson Show podcast. Always free, GuyBensonShow.com. So, a Washington Post story that a farm has canceled its goat snuggling events after critics said it was exploitation. I guess this was like a mental health thing where people could like cuddle with cute little baby goats. And then people said that's unfair to the goats. So now the goat snuggling's over. It's canceled. Sorry, everyone. But it might still be available up in New Jersey, because I know producer Christine is in the process of planning a birthday party for her daughter. And she is apparently accepting every single piece of advice and suggestion that anyone gives about what this party should entail. It should entail everything. And I was thinking maybe it should also involve goat snuggling for the children, because the children might want to snuggle these goats. But then I remembered how things usually turn out for animals when they are in the care of producer Christine. And I don't want these baby goats to become like, you know, a gyro or, you know, a taco. Because we all recall what happened to poor Carousel. R.I.P. moment of silence all those many years ago. So let's just scale back on that idea. Let's just back away slowly from the goat snuggling.
Wait,
Christine.
Hold on 1 second. What? I do have okay. Goat thoughts. Is that okay. A term?
It is now.
I have thoughts about goats. I actually wanted a goat growing up on my horse farm, because someone had mentioned when I told them that my pony was an iron-footed beast and I hated her, that maybe sometimes horses tend to calm down and aren't as crazy if they live with a goat, like, you know, in their pen.
So you wanted a goat to help with Carousel, the pony that you hated.
Yes. And I figured maybe I would like her more if she was nice. She was just mean. So I figured maybe the goat would have to deal with all her meanness. And then when I came, she'd be a lot nicer. My parents
never got the goat.
No, we never got a goat. And like things could have been so different.
That cost Carousel her life, because once the mean, evil pony didn't have a goat, then it was off to the old, you know, I'm doing the old throat slit.
That's not
gesture.
You know,
right,
that's not
now.
What happened.
You did that. You looked over at your sort of connected wise guys that you knew in New Jersey with the little throat slit gesture, and they said, "We got it." And you just sort of turned away like you hadn't just ordered this assassination, but everyone knew exactly what you meant. And she was exterminated, and her carcass was left in a dump, like a garbage dump in Staten Island, as her soul went off to the old golden corral in the sky. And perhaps all of that could have been avoided, all of that cruelty with a goat. But of course, the other side is, if the goat hadn't worked, I mean, child Christine would want to tie up that loose end as well, if you know what I mean. So sweet Goatie would be sleeping with the fishes with some where their hoofs in concrete. So it's probably for the best that we didn't bring another innocent creature into this nightmare of death and destruction. But anyway, Christine, let's talk about your daughter's birthday party. How exciting. It's this weekend. Is this the big 1-0?
This is her 10th birthday. I can't believe 10 years ago I was ready to give birth. It feels, I know, so cliche, but it really does feel like yesterday in some ways, and I can't believe how quick time flies, but we really truly enjoy her. Don't worry, she's going to stay. We'll keep her around. We like her.
Oh, Wyatt was just telling me he's surprised that it's been 10 years. It seemed like almost like a medical miracle that you were able to give birth at that age 10 years ago.
Wyatt said that?
God works in mysterious ways, and now we have sweet Megan.
I did not say that. I just want the record to be known. I did not say
anything.
Many
people are saying that Wyatt hinted at that it was a look. He didn't say it. He just, you know, it was a look, and I interpreted, as I'm very good at. Not quite as good as certain psychics and mediums at interpreting things, but close. So anyway, Christine, so 10 years old.
Yes.
As of this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So you're calling this like an everything bagel birthday, something
no,
like that?
No, it's the theme, and I don't understand why nobody gets it, and how I don't know how else to explain it, but like the theme, it's rainbows, like happiness, but the theme is 10 is everything. Get it? Like, does that make sense to anybody here?
No.
Bobby didn't understand it, and the more I kept saying it, he's like, you just keep saying the same thing, but
wait,
I don't
so
understand
hang on. The
what
theme
means.
Is the theme is rainbows because 10 is everything?
Yeah, like, I'm going to have a sign that says 10 is everything. Like, it's just, she's 10.
But what's the rainbow, though? What's the rainbow?
Oh, like, she loves rainbows. So, like, you know, a lot
But what
of,
does that have to do with, why does that signify everything?
Happiness everywhere. Rainbows. Damn. I don't know how to actually explain this.
I love he's just like bellowing with laughter in the background. That is good stuff. The crickets. It doesn't make any sense, but you know, if it floats your boat and she likes it, that's great. So within that theme,
mm-hmm.
beyond the rainbow sign, like what are you doing to signify that 10 is everything?
So she doesn't. Some of the things I'm doing is she doesn't do cake. Like, she doesn't eat cake at all.
Does she eat cookies?
She likes some cookies. Not all cookies, but she does like some okay. cookies. She does
well,
like
we
donuts.
Also like some, but not all cookies here. But go on.
Oh, my God. I'm just going to ignore you. She does like donuts. So I'm trying to figure out, like, have you seen on Pinterest, like, donut walls?
Yes.
So I can order one on Amazon, but, like, I want the donuts are everything. Like, you know, I want to tie it all in. And the only way I can think of, sorry, Bobby, but I think tonight he's got to go to Home Depot. And I think we have to actually make it ourselves.
Could you not just buy a donut wall and donuts? Would that be too expensive? Would that be like, say, $400 to $600 that you don't have right now? because of previous decisions.
Did I do something to you? Is there some reason why you're so angry?
Where do I start?
My favorite thing of all this is, like, we're just wrecking on her for being a great mother and, like, and just having a great party for her daughter.
Allegedly a great mother, because I keep interrupting her before she talks about anything that she's actually doing with this party. But it sounds like there's a lot that's already gone into the party. And I guess the question is, does the donut wall enhance everything to the point that it's, like, really necessary? Like, what have you already done for this child's birthday party?
You know how, like, kids, when you leave a birthday party, you leave with, like, a goodie bag?
Oh, yeah.
Like, just of candy and a little. Yeah. No, I'm not doing that. So what I'm doing for the girls.
Liquor?
I did actually mention an ice luge to Dan.
Oh, my goodness.
An ice luge?
Yeah, but, like, we would do.
I said no.
Like, for virgin daiquiris?
Yeah, like, we would do Gatorade or something. Wouldn't that be fun?
It's like, oh, here's a Capri Sun, kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, put your head right there, Megan. You could do a ski shot.
I was thinking a rainbow.
Just of, like, Kool-Aid. Kool-Aid.
Like, think about the rainbow and then put different color Gatorades, like, down it for this. No?
Yeah. Okay. Gatorade is everything.
So I'm going to do makeup bags for each girl. And the makeup bag has a rainbow on it and then, like, an affirmation. So there's, I think, 25 people coming. So each one, like, one will say, you're smart. You're strong.
You're beautiful. Here's
you're beautiful.
Some makeup.
Yes. Well, that's what Bobby said. He goes, I think we should take the beautiful one out. I was like, no, I don't think so. But, oh, yeah, I didn't.
It's like, you might need just a little bit of cover up. Here you go. There you go, sweetie. Run off. Thank you. Beautiful. I think they'll like that. I think 10 is an age where 10-year-old girls, like, you know, and the parents can decide whether they want to use it or how much they want to use. But I think that's, like, a fun little bag.
Well,
I'm
not done.
Candy.
No, I'm not done.
Oh, okay.
So then I'm going to do, like, all rainbow-themed stuff. So, like, rainbow lollipops, rainbow jewelry, like, little bracelets and stuff. And then I'm doing rainbow, like, lip scrub, rainbow lip gloss. And what I did is, instead of just putting it all in the makeup case, I got these cellophane bags. And I would put, like, the Easter grass on the bottom and then, like, fill the bag. And then I got rainbow ribbons. So this is going to be a process. This is, like, 25 bags I need to do. And then, of course, I need to do...
Oh, hasn't been done yet?
No, I'm still waiting.
Is
on
this
some
on
of the...
Saturday?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Today's Wednesday. You still got some time. What's, like, the, because we know the theme, we know the giveaways. Like, what's the actual party? Like,
the party,
what's the entertainment?
Is gymnastics.
What's the food? Okay.
And then there's a second.
And
you
are a part-time unauthorized gymnastics coach, as it turns out.
I can't believe I'm actually going to be able to stay because it's her coach. Remember Savannah, who kicked me out?
Yes, I do. One of my heroes.
Megan begged for Savannah to be the gym party teacher. So I guess I get to stay this time. Very exciting. And then, you know, we have pizza. I wanted to do a candy bar there at the gymnastics place. But Bobby was like, hold up, woman. Like, this is a lot going on. But we are bringing.
Is there pineapple on the pizza, or are you going to, like, let the kids have good pizza?
We're just going to do regular pizza because I
think,
you know.
That's right. Plain, maybe pepperoni. Usually those are the options.
That's what Bobby said. I thought all plain, but Bobby's like, we might need a few, like, pepperonis.
Okay, I like that.
So after this is done, I'm still working on some other things, like, you know, her T-shirt that says 10 is everything, what me and Bobby are going to wear as the parents of the party girl. I had sent you an option, but Megan said, please, mommy, no. And it said, I gave birth 10 years ago. Where's my wine? Where's my wine?
And she vetoed that?
She vetoed it.
Wow. It's almost as if she really falls very far from the tree in terms of taste and class. And that's great. Good for her. Putting her foot down for her own. I mean, this is a big birthday, right? All of a sudden, she's in the double digits. That's
right,
a big thing.
It's everything. See? You're starting to understand. So then, once we leave that big party, we narrow it down to, like, 5 to 10 girls. And in our apartment.
There's a special after party?
Yes. And I'm like.
Exclusive.
Yes. But I'm, like, praying she doesn't, like, you know, I hope it just doesn't get out. Because, like, you don't want to hurt other people.
Oh, it's going to get out.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. No, there'll be a whole drama around it.
Don't say that.
Welcome to being the daughter of, like, now a preteen. Oh, yeah. It's going to be a thing. This is the exclusive list. Oh, I'm sorry. Your name's not on the list. You're not allowed into this
the movie
apartment.
Theater. Yeah.
Oh, it's a movie theater. I thought it was
in
your apartment. It's just like,
in our apartment.
Mommy, I want to go to that woman's place. There's a big sign that says, it's wine o'clock on the wall. That seems fun. What does that mean?
How did you know I had that? I have that sign.
No, you do?
Yes.
Do you have live, laugh,
Did
love
I,
as well?
I used to have a huge, it was like live, laugh, love.
One.
It was like a huge one. That was like the focal point of Over the Couch was my live, laugh, love.
That been replaced with something that says wine is everything?
Wine is everything, but I don't have that yet. But no, we have a movie theater in our apartment complex.
That you've reserved.
Right. And then so then,
what's the movie? What's the feature film?
The Parent Trap with Lindsay Lohan. It's her favorite movie.
Classic. No,
she
that's great.
Loves that movie.
We love that.
But then I'm doing like Welcome to Megan's Movie Extravaganza. So each girl gets a personalized popcorn bucket. I still have to get the buckets and I still have to personalize them. Then
That's a lot.
I am doing like candy just for each bucket. Or maybe a candy bar. I have to think about
Christine, it. Christine, we're almost out of time here, yeah. But I have to say, here's one more idea. What if then you narrow it down to just two girls who get to do a slumber party?
We do.
You can do it like a reality show where they have to earn being the best friends who get to stay and the other ones get voted off the island.
Well, I'm glad you asked that because there are two girls. There's two girls from everything that are sleeping over.
Nailed it. And at that age, slumber parties are everything. Well, good luck. Sounds like you've got a lot of work ahead of you. Good luck with the donut wall and the goats. We might need some security for the goats, the ice luge. I mean, wow. It's a big, big process. It's yet another party that Christine's throwing that I'm not invited to. And that's perfectly fine this time because it'd be creepy for me to be there. But other than that, we'll keep tabs on the big extravaganza. Happy early birthday to Megan. Many reports to come, I'm sure. Back here tomorrow for the Guy Benson Show. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you then.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.